You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Soul Economy and Waldorf Education, Collected Works, Volume 303, translated by Roland Everett. This is Lecture 7, given in Dornach on the 29th of December, 1921. Anyone called upon to look after a very young child, either as a parent or in any other child-caring capacity, will experience the great responsibility such a task entails. He or she will feel morally obliged, through the way of looking after the child, to lay the best foundations for its future development. It therefore grieves me deeply that we in our Waldorf school in Stuttgart can accept only children who have already reached the official school age, and it would give me the greatest satisfaction if we could also take in children of younger ages. Footnote, the sixth year was the official school age in 1921. A kindergarten was opened in the Waldorf school some 4 years after this lecture was given, that is, in Easter 1926. End of footnote. But, apart from other difficulties, our aims at opening a nursery class have been thwarted by a lack of funds, as happened with so many other of our anthroposophical activities. This ever-present shortage of money at least leaves us with the hope that if we can win the support of the general public, we shall eventually be able to build up a nursery class as an intrinsic part of our Waldorf school. A very young child is the least accessible of all to us. The gates to its soul life are absolutely closed against the outer world. No outer influence can touch it. Anyone who has charge of an infant of this age, whilst it struggles and cries, is powerless. The child does what it wants. Thus an observant adult will accept the fact that the child's will is beyond his control, even as far as later stages, and sometimes the latest stages of its future life are concerned. You may know that early in 1890, well before publishing other anthroposophical literature, I published my book titled The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, Readers Aside, also known as title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, also known as The Philosophy of Freedom, end of Readers Aside. The purpose of this book was to put into the world a true assessment of that part in man which develops the impulse toward freedom of the full human personality, also seen within the social context. If one accepts its content, the problem of freedom on the one side and that of destiny on the other becomes relevant already when one is confronted by a babe in arms. You may know that early in 1890, well before publishing other anthroposophical literature, I published my book titled The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity. Readers aside, this is also known as title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, and also as title The Philosophy of Freedom, end of readers aside. The purpose of this book was to put into the world a true assessment of that part in man which develops the impulse toward freedom of the full human personality, also seen within the social context. If one accepts its content, the problem of freedom on the one side and that of destiny on the other becomes relevant already when one is confronted by a babe in arms. If one listens to what lives in the human heart, one can find that man's true happiness on earth depends on the awareness of his human freedom, on his appreciation of human values, and on his feeling for human dignity. Anthroposophy shows us that apart from what a person may have developed already before birth or conception, while still living in the spiritual world, and apart from what he or she will meet again after death, the very purpose of earthly incarnation consists in bringing to life the impulse toward freedom. This impulse is totally dependent on man's plunging into an earthly body. It can be realized only in physical incarnation. We can attain to freedom only while living on earth, and we can take with us into other worlds only the degree of freedom which we have achieved down here on earth. If one approaches the young child with such feelings, and feelings are the most potent source for those engaged in the art of education, the following question will be ever present in the mind of a person who has charge of an infant. What must I do to enable this child to develop to the fullest extent the consciousness of human freedom when it reaches maturity? And with this question another truth begins to dawn, a fact to which outer conditions of life are already clearly pointing, and which, through anthroposophical insight, can be understood with inner certainty, namely the fact that despite his freedom, each person has a destiny, or to call it by its Eastern terminology, his or her karma. Let us imagine that later in life someone meets another person whom he or she has known before, and that this other person exercises a profound influence upon the life of the first individual. Perhaps two such people might even enter into a partnership for life. At first it may appear to them as if their meeting were the result of mere chance. But when looking back over the previous years of their lives, even without any knowledge of anthroposophical spiritual science, the first individuality may well discover the strange fact that during the years prior to this meeting, he or she had unconsciously taken all kinds of steps which eventually led to the other person. What at first appeared the result of chance, with hindsight, revealed an inherent pattern, an underlying plan. Looking back over his life, Goethe's old friend Knebel uttered these significant words from the depths of his soul, quote, "If in later years one surveys one's previous life, everything seems to fall into a definite pattern. Everything fits together." Close quote. Since our will is woven into all our actions, we can see everywhere how destiny confronts us in the happenings of our life. One could quote many other personalities who, through purely outward observation of life, also reached the same conclusion. If we look at life's external happenings, we find confirmation of the hidden truths of karma. Anyone in charge of young children, especially those who are working in children's homes, who is aware of the working of destiny, must ask the question, "Have I been specially chosen to fulfill the important task of guiding and educating this child or these children?" And then other questions will follow. What must I do to obliterate, as far as possible, my personal self, in order to leave those entrusted in my care free from being burdened by my own subjective nature? How must I act so that I do not interfere with the child's destiny? And above all, how can I best educate the child toward freedom? If one learns to understand what is going on in a child between birth and the change of teeth, that is, during his first seven-year period of life, I shall speak about the embryonic development later on, one realizes how vulnerable such a child is, and how deeply we can affect the being of such a young child. The change of teeth represents a decisive turning point in the life of the child. Upon close observation, one will find that after the seventh year, an entirely new interrelationship will emerge between the child's thinking, feeling, and willing. We have grown accustomed to apply certain concepts, gained from the observation of material processes, also to the life of man. For instance, if, when watching natural processes, we notice a sudden emergence of heat which had not been perceptible in a previous state, and which had not been outwardly introduced, we speak of latent heat being set free. Just as latent heat can be set free by material processes, so soul and spirit forces are set free after the change of teeth, forces which hitherto have been bound up with the organism because they were instrumental to its growth. Freed from processes of growth and nourishment, These forces can now work in the child's soul sphere. They have been transmuted into soul forces. Natural science today forms abstract conceptions about the relationship of body and soul and vice versa. Theories are made regarding the effects of one upon the other. One speaks of a psycho-physical parallelism, and so on. Instead of making exact observations, one philosophizes. But all this will lead us nowhere. If one wishes to fathom the secrets of human nature, one has to observe it with the same exactitude with which the phenomena of outer nature have been observed. And then one will discover that after approximately the 7th year, forces previously engaged in the building up of the child's physical organism are being transformed into soul forces, which then determine the child's relationship with the outer world. If we wish to find out what the soul of a child is like between birth and the 7th year, we have to observe the child's development from the 7th year onward. For then, in the child's soul, we are able to observe the very same forces which previously were active in its physical organization. And we shall find that their hidden organic activity of molding and shaping the child's brain, as well as its remaining organization, is of a very special significance. For through birth or conception, the child carries down into its physical organization what it has brought with it from the worlds of soul and spirit. When the child is thus fully engaged in building up its physical organs, it must be left free to do so, and consequently the doors leading to the outer world remain closed. It is essential that we refrain from interfering in our clumsy ways with these inner activities of the child, for it is doing what it has to do, with the effect that it is not accessible to external will forces. On the other hand, we must also realize that despite the child's preoccupation with its own processes of growing, everything we do in its vicinity, nevertheless, makes a deep and incisive impression upon it. I shall go into further detail later, but we must never forget that what will work in the realm of the child's soul after the 7th year is directly involved in the organ-building processes before that age. This means that up to the 7th year, any impressions coming from the outer world will directly affect its physical constitution, the lungs, stomach, liver, and all kinds of other organs. Just because at this age the child's soul has not yet become emancipated from its physical organization, where it is still actively engaged, all impressions which come from us through our conduct and general behavior will have a decisive effect upon its future constitution of health or illness. You have come here with the expectation of learning something about our principles of education, but it is the practical application of these principles which is all important. What really matters in education is the mood and attitude of soul which the teacher carries in his heart with regard to the being of man. Only if we approach the growing human being with true insight shall we be good servants of the art of education. One could even go as far as saying, each teacher is free to approach his subjects in his own individual way, for in any case he will have to prepare the relevant subject matter according to what he has learned from life. What really matters is that each child carries within himself a true picture of man, and if this picture stands there before his inner gaze, he or she will act rightly, though outwardly possibly in very different ways. When, as the spiritual guide of the Waldorf School, I visited parallel classes, because of our large numbers we already have parallel classes, and when I witness how each teacher treats the same subject very much in his or her own individual manner, I never object or insist that they all should follow the same set courses. Even if two versions of the same subject may outwardly appear contradictory, each one may, nevertheless, be right in its own way. In fact, if one teacher were to copy another, the results could be entirely wrong. It is not for nothing that our school is called Free Waldorf School, not only because of our independence from the state system, but very much because of the atmosphere of freedom which pervades its entire constitution. During the previous lecture, I drew attention to the fact that a supersensible contemplation of man will reveal to us, apart from his physical body, another finer body, which we have called the etheric body, or the body of formative forces. From this etheric body spring not only all the forces sustaining nourishment and growth, but it is also the source of the faculties of remembering and of making mental images, of ideation. It becomes an independent entity only during the change of teeth, at which time it is born in a similar way in which, at physical birth, the body is born from its mother. This means that up to the change of teeth, the forces of the etheric body are entirely working in the processes of the child's organic growth, whereas after that time, though still remaining active in this realm to a great extent, they partly withdraw from these activities. These released forces of the ether body now begin to work in the soul realm of mental picturing and memory, as well as in the many other nuances of the child's soul life. The change of teeth is a unique event. The forces needed to push out the second teeth existed prior to this event, but they are no longer needed afterward. Once the second teeth have appeared, this particular activity of the etheric body becomes redundant. The final activity of pushing out the second teeth is an outward manifestation of the kind of working that is going on in the child's organism. Now, at the end of the first 7-year period, most of these etheric forces are released to flow into the child's soul and spiritual nature. One can recognize such 7-year periods throughout the entire course of human life. And each of these periods, again, falls into 3 clearly differentiated, shorter periods. If we observe the gradual withdrawal of some of these etheric forces until approximately the 7th year, we can see how in the first 2.5 years, after physical birth, the etheric body frees itself from the head region, how in the following 2.5 years it frees itself from the chest region, and finally up to the change of teeth from the child's metabolic and limb system. Thus we can recognize 3 phases within the gradual withdrawal of etheric forces. And one can clearly recognize how, when the etheric body is still bound up with the head region, the child rejects any intentional influence coming from outside. What the child learns during this first 2.5-year period is of utmost importance for its whole life. It does so through an inward bound activity, out of what it has brought with it from its prenatal existence. Only consider how, during this first short period, the child learns to speak and to walk, the 2 human faculties closely connected with an individual's maintaining a proper self-confidence, both from a personal and a social point of view. These 2 important faculties are achieved while the etheric body is still engaged in shaping the brain, and while it is still raying out into the remaining organism. If these etheric forces ray out too strongly into the remaining organism, so that they disturb the infant's still delicate processes of metabolism, of breathing and blood circulation, if they surge too powerfully within the baby's organism, scarlet fever and kindred children's illnesses may occur already at this young age. Fundamentally speaking, through all that is at work within a child at that age, the child remains inaccessible to any conscious and will-directed approaches or demands coming from outside. It wants to be left to work on its own organism. This inaccessibility to the outer world, during the first 2.5 years, is the one significant factor. The other is the fact that the child has a fine instinctive perception for everything that is happening in its surroundings, and especially for what is going on in the persons with whom it has established a certain rapport. Anyone looking after such a child naturally belongs to this category. I am not speaking now of the child's ability to use its senses in the way an older person does. It is not what it can see with its eyes that I am referring to, but to a general perceiving of a most intimate kind of what is happening in its surroundings. This perceiving, however, excludes anything that seeks to impose itself from outside, against which the child will defend itself instinctively during those first 2.5 years. In order to understand better this susceptibility to the outer world, at a time when its sense perceptions are still deeply immersed in feeling, it might help if we look at the creatures immediately below man, namely at the animals, for they display a similar sensitivity toward the outer world to a specially high degree. I am not here contradicting my remarks about senility made to you in a previous lecture. One simply has to observe accurately. The animal is especially sensitive to its surroundings. I do not know whether those of you who have come from England or from the other European countries have ever heard of the horses which, a few years before the war, created a sensation because they seemed to be able to do simple arithmetical calculations. In Berlin there was the famous horse of Herr von Osten, and in Elbefeld there were several horses which could reckon with numbers. Well, I cannot say anything about the Elberfeld horses, but I did make the acquaintance of Herr von Osten's horse in Berlin, and I could observe the close relationship that existed between this horse and its master. It is quite true that the horse stamped with its legs 3 3s are 9, which for a horse is quite a respectable achievement. All kinds of theories were advanced in order to explain the horse's reactions to the questions put to it by Herr von Osten. There was a certain university lecturer, a most erudite man, who even wrote a whole book about this horse. He wrote, quote, "Of course, the horse cannot calculate, but whenever Herr von Osten says 3 times 3, he accompanies his words by hardly noticeable facial expressions. He does a kind of miming, and when he pronounces the word 9, the horse, which is capable of observing these facial expressions, will stamp accordingly." Close quote. His was indeed a learned treatise. The author continued, quote, "I myself was not able to detect the miming on Herr von Osten's face, and therefore I cannot guarantee that my theory is correct. But it must have been there, and the horse was able to observe it." Close quote. To me, the author merely states that he, a university lecturer, considered the horse to be more capable of observation than he was himself. In my opinion, the crucial point was Herr von Osten's procedure, for he had large pockets filled with sweetmeats, which he shoved into the horse's mouth, thus maintaining an uninterrupted flow of sensation and gratification. The result was an intimate relationship between master and horse. All happenings were immersed in a feeling of sympathy, which made the horse, in accordance with its animal nature, extremely receptive to all that came from its master, even to his thoughts and all the shades of his feelings, but hardly to the play of mysterious expressions on his face. The processes of calculation going on in Herr von Osten's mind were transferred to the horse via the taste of sweetness. This phenomenon does not become any the less interesting if interpreted in this way. It can teach us a great deal about the relationship of living beings, but it cannot be explained hypothetically by the observation of facial expressions which a horse could make, though not a university lecturer. During the first 2.5 years, the child too has a similar rapport with its mother, or with other persons closely connected with it, as long as their attitude and conduct make it possible. And then the child becomes a perfect mimic, a complete imitator. This imposes upon the grown-up the moral duty to be worthy of imitation, which is a far less comfortable task than exerting one's will upon the child. The child will take in everything we do, the way we act, or the way we move. It is equally susceptible to all our feelings and thoughts. It imitates us. And if this is not outwardly noticeable, it nevertheless does so by developing tendencies for imitation, which by means of its organ-bound soul forces, it presses down into its physical organism. Therefore, education during these first 2.5 years should be confined to the self-education of the adult in charge, who should think, feel, and act in a manner which, when perceived by the child, will cause it no harm. Fundamentally, the stage of imitation continues up to the change of teeth, and therefore the child will be strongly influenced by its surroundings also in later years, as the following example may show. 2 disconsolate parents once came to me saying, quote, "Our child has always been a good child, but now it has stolen money." Close quote. Was this really so? At a superficial glance, yes, for it had taken money out of the cupboard where it was always kept by its mother. The child then had bought sweets with the money, and even distributed some among other children. I reassured the parents that their child had not stolen at all, but that it had merely imitated its mother, who regularly had taken money out of the cupboard in order to buy things. There never was any intention of stealing, the concept of which was as yet non-existent in the child's mind. But the child is an imitator. It will do what mother does, and if one wishes to avoid confusion, it is up to the grown-up to realize this fact and to act differently in front of the child. We must also be careful not to harm the child's development when it is learning to speak. This can easily happen if we make it say words of our own choice, which again amounts to imposing our will upon the child. It is best for us to speak naturally in front of the child, provided our talking is of a moral order, so that it has the opportunity of hearing us. In this way, the child will find its own way into language. Neither will the child learn to walk through our efforts at making it stand up and do all kinds of movements. Such instruction belongs to the gym lessons of a much later age. If we intervene by making it stand and walk prematurely, we can do irreparable damage to its nerve processes. This damage may persist for the whole of its later life. If the child sees the adults in their upright position, as imitator, it will raise itself to the same position when the right time comes. We must always regard the human being, during the first stages, as an imitating being, and arrange our upbringing accordingly. This certainly can be very trying at times. We all know that there are babies who seem to be yelling all day long, and who, apart from their ear-splitting noise, inflict all kinds of other provocations upon the adult. True, there are situations which have to be dealt with, even quite drastically, in order to avoid serious damage being done by the child, but such measures do not really belong to the field of education. Admittedly, it is hard to put up with a screaming child, but if we behave in the way indicated, our conduct will gradually sink into the deeper layers of the child's soul and spiritual forces, which are still closely bound up with organic processes, and will, eventually, bring about more positive results. If one observes small children without prejudice, one will find that their screaming and other unpleasant features come from the child's physical organization, though the forces inherent in intense crying will remain with the child, the habit of crying will gradually pass. These forces certainly are of a great intensity. If we influence the child rightly by setting the right example and by acting morally, the forces underlying the baby's crying will reveal themselves as intensely moral forces in later life. A strong morality in adult life is the expression of the same forces which lived in intense crying during early childhood. On the other hand, if the persons close to the child have an immoral attitude, be it only in thoughts, these same forces will reappear later as intensely immoral forces. You will now be able to appreciate the real point of what has been said so far, namely that one must not be tempted by a false kind of instinct. It is not even an instinct, but something we may have brought with us through misguided customs, to make baby talk for the child's benefit. Nurses or others dealing with young children should never speak to them in an artificial or childish manner. We really do a great wrong if we change our normal way of speaking to suit, in quotes, the child. For the child always wants to imitate us, as we really are, and not as we pretend to be. It rejects anything that comes toward it as an expression of another person's will, such as childish and naive baby talk. The child has to put up with it, but it has a deep inner resentment toward such an approach. The after effects of this often well-meant folly may be so far-reaching as to come to light in later years as a weakened digestion. What is diagnosed in an older patient as symptoms of a weak digestion may well be nothing else but the result of the wrong approach of an overzealous but misguided nurse during the patient's early childhood. These are the main points regarding the first third of the first seven-year period, which need to be borne in mind. At the age of 2.5, the child's head organization is developed far enough for those forces of the ether body which have been working on it to become released. This gradual withdrawal continues into the chest region up to about the 5th year, when breathing and blood circulation also have reached a certain stage of completion, so that by the time the child has learned to speak and to walk, the formative forces, released from the head, acting now as soul and spiritual forces, join those which are being released in the chest region. This change can be recognized outwardly by the emergence of an exceptionally vivid memory which the child develops between 2.5 and 5, as also by its wonderful imagination. However, great care must be taken when the child develops these two faculties, which are instrumental to the upbuilding of its soul. The child continues to live by imitation, and therefore we should not attempt to make it remember anything of our own choice. At this stage, it is best to leave the evolving forces of memory alone, allowing the child to remember whatever it pleases. On no account should one give it memory exercises of any kind. Otherwise, in one's ignorance, one might be responsible for consequences which can be observed if one looks upon the entire course of human life. Sometimes one meets people who, around the age of 40 or even later, complain of shooting pains, of rheumatism. This ailment certainly can have many different causes, but if research is carried far enough, it may reveal that the rheumatism is due to premature overloading of the memory during early childhood. The pattern of life indeed is very complex, and only by trying to recognize its many hidden links can we engender the love which is the true basis of the growing human being. Whatever one's attitude may be, as educators, we must respond to the child's imagination or fantasy, which seeks to express itself outwardly through its playing with toys or in games with other children. This urge to play between the age of 2.5 and 5 is really nothing but the externalized activity of the child's powers of fantasy. And if one has the necessary ability of observation for such matters, one can foretell a great deal regarding the child's future soul life, its character, and so on, merely by watching it at play. The way in which such a young child plays is a clear indication of its potential gifts and faculties in later life. What is of utmost importance now is that one meets this inborn urge to play with the right toys. People in past times have responded to this according to their own particular understanding. I do not know whether this also happened in the West, but at one time a regular epidemic spread throughout Middle Europe of giving children boxes of building bricks, especially at Christmas time, out of separate cubic and quadrilateral stones, the children were meant to build miniature architectural monstrosities. This kind of thing has a far-reaching effect upon the development of the child's imagination, for it begets an atomistic, materialistic attitude, a mentality which always wants to put bits and pieces together to form a whole. If one wants to come to terms with practical life, it is far better to allow full play to the child's ever-mobile and living imaginative powers than to foster intellectual capacities which encourage the atomistic nature of present-day thinking. The child's imagination represents the very forces which have just freed themselves from performing similar creative work within the physical formation of its brain. It is for this reason that one must avoid, as far as this is possible, forcing these powers of imagination into rigid and finished forms. Let us imagine two nurses who are looking after a child between 2.5 and 5 years old. One of them, she may be very fond of the little girl in her charge, gives it a, in quotes, beautiful doll, a doll that has not only painted cheeks and real hair, but even eyes that close and a movable head. I believe there are dolls that can even speak. Well, she gives such a doll to the little girl, but as it is finished in every detail, there is nothing left for the child's imagination to create. Its yearning for creative mobility cannot be satisfied. It is as if its forces of imagination were put into a straitjacket. The other nurse, who has a little more understanding for the inner needs of the child, takes an old piece of cloth which is of no use for anything else. She winds a thread around its upper end until something resembling a head appears. She may even ask the little girl to paint 2 black dots on the face, perhaps even more, for eyes, nose, and mouth. Because now the child's imagination is stimulated, because it can be creative instead of having to put up with fixed and finished forms and contours, the child experiences a far more lively and intimate response than with the so-called beautiful doll. Toys, as far as this is possible, should leave the child's power of fantasy free. And since intellect is not the same as fantasy or imagination, the activity of putting together many parts is hardly in harmony with the type of fantasy which is characteristic of a child of this age. Anything that calls forth an inner feeling of liveliness and mobility is always most suitable for the young child. For example, a children's book with cut-out and tastefully colored figures, which can be moved by pulling strings attached below, so that they will do all kinds of things, such as embracing or thrashing each other, always stimulates the child to invent whole stories, and in this way is an extraordinarily wholesome means of play activity. In a similar way, games with other children should not be too formal, but they should leave plenty of scope for the child's imagination. All these suggestions spring from a knowledge of man, which is founded upon reality, and which enables the educator to acquire the necessary insights, especially as regards the practical side of life. When the child approaches the 5th year, the forces of the etheric body, which hitherto have been building up the breathing and the blood circulation, now become available for other activities. And likewise, up to the change of teeth, etheric forces will struggle free, which, after completing their task within the metabolic and limb system, have now become redundant. At that time, new spiritual and soul forces are gradually awakening, which will emerge fully only after the 7th year, and which we shall study in more detail later on. However, they already shine with a dawning light into this last and 3rd period, which concludes the 1st 7-year period of human life. When etheric forces from the chest region reappear as soul and spiritual forces, the child is becoming amenable to exhortations, to what belongs to a sense of authority. previously unable to understand what it ought or ought not to do, it could only imitate. But now, little by little, it begins to listen to and to believe in what its elders say. Only toward the fifth year is it possible to awaken in a child the sense of what is right or wrong. We will educate the child rightly only if we realize that during the first seven-year period, that is, up to the change of teeth, the child lives by imitation, and that only gradually will it develop imagination and memory, as well as a first belief in what grown-ups say. This faith in the adult induces a feeling of authority, especially for the teacher with whom it has a very close relationship. However, at this stage, the child is still too young for any kind of formal education. It pains me to know that already the sixth year has been fixed as the official school age. Children ought not to enter school proper before their seventh year. I was therefore always glad to hear, and I don't mind if you consider this attitude quite uncivilized, that children of some anthroposophists had no knowledge of writing and reading even at the age of eight. What can be accomplished with forces available only at a later time should never be crammed into an earlier stage, unless one is prepared to ruin the physical organism. In the next few days, I will show you how we try to treat our children without inflicting any harm upon them when they have entered the Waldorf School. Tomorrow I will make a beginning by introducing you to the Waldorf School, of course, only by word of mouth. The end of Lecture 7.